Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks UK episode number 2, and in this episode I'm going to be looking at the right reforms to the House of Commons. Now, to put this into some context, the right reforms were sort of commissioned, there was a committee set up back in 2007, and the reason for this was concerns have been growing over the executive dominance or the government's dominance over Parliament, particularly under Tony Blair's leadership in his first two terms, feeling that Prime Ministers had become too powerful and that the House of Commons had effectively just become a rubber stamp. So Chairman Dr. Tony Wright, who was an MP at the time, headed up this House of Commons Reform Committee, hence why it's known as the Right Reforms, and they issued their reforms or their proposals in 2009. As it happened, at the moment their proposals were made, the Commons became embroiled in the expenses scandal. So they were lucky, in a sense, that there was a demand to do something to shake up Parliament and make sure the House of Commons was a bit more reformed. Now, these reforms took many different areas, and some of the proposals were introduced. Some of them, however, were not and were ignored for various reasons. So we're just going to look at some of the reforms, some of the key things that have happened, what was left out, and the impact that these have had on British politics to date. So to begin with, we will address select committees. And this is probably one of the most significant reforms that came through. The Wright report suggested that chairmen and women of select committees should be put into position by a secret ballot of the whole House of Commons. And this would remove the power of the whips and the government to dominate the proceedings of the committee. In addition to that, the members of a select committee would be elected by secret ballot of the parties. So select committees would remain, having their makeup reflect that of party representation in the House of Commons. So there would still be, you'd assume, a government majority on a particular select committee. But the membership would be decided by the party, therefore pretty much the backbenchers, in a secret vote, rather than by the party whips. So this would give the select committees a little bit more independence, although they would, the government party would still dominate them. Now, significant advantage of these select committee reforms was obviously the decline in power of whips over select committee procedures and hearings. And this has helped to reinvigorate the select committees and seemingly made them more independent of the government, particularly the independently elected select committee chairs, and the fact that they now get an additional pay for being chairperson of select committee. This can be as much as £10,000 a year extra. The result of that pay and that independence means becoming and remaining a chairperson of a select committee is now a viable alternative career to becoming a minister. So backbenchers who want to advance in politics might now decide to go through the select committee route rather than trying to achieve ministerial post, therefore not feeling obliged to toe the party line in hope of future promotion. So those two things have been very good, and they have made the committees more effective. However, there have been a number of cons to the select committee reforms. The first one is they still have relatively little power. The House of Commons select committees report to the House, and the government is obliged to respond to them, but it is not obliged to do anything. So whatever the committee finds, its power remains just to publicise it and hope for the best. It cannot compel the government to do anything, nor can it compel people to attend its hearings or give evidence. It can put pressure on them and media scrutiny, as they did with Mike Ashley, the head of Sports Direct, but there is no legal power to oblige people to attend. The independence has also had, if you like, a negative effect, with some of the members of select committees becoming overly aggressive in their questioning. You could argue trying to get airtime on TV, and really being overly aggressive in their questioning and grandstanding for the public gaze rather than actually dealing with the issues and behaviour and questioning that wouldn't be accepted in a court of law, but they're able to get away with it. So that's a negative of this increased independence. That links into another slight issue that the select committees have. which is the idea of parliamentary privilege. There are things that can be said by the people on select committees when interviewing. They can make sweeping statements or accusations, and they're covered by parliamentary privilege, which means they cannot be sued or arrested for anything that they have said. However, the people they are interviewing are not covered by that. So if they say something that they could get something slanderous, they could get into trouble for that, or they could lose their job if they've revealed a company secret and they weren't supposed to. So there is an imbalance here, which undermines the effectiveness of select committees. Another significant one is to do with the size of select committees. Now, most select committees are around 11 members, but some are much larger. Now, one of the original right reform proposals was to actually increase the representation of smaller parties. And the way Wright proposed to do this was to allow the chairman and women of select committees to fill vacancies that occur on their committee from minor parties. Now, that reform hasn't happened, possibly because the two major parties weren't keen on the idea. Obviously, the advantage there was it would give the minor parties in Parliament more of a chance of representing their views, and it would give the chairmen and women of the select committees the opportunity to hear from a wider range of MPs with more backgrounds and greater diversity, which would be useful in forming judgments. There's also been another issue, which is the chairmen and women of select committees want to reduce the size of select committees, feeling that 11 or more is too unwieldy and it makes select committees less effective. And this is where we have something of a clash. In order to keep select committees representing party makeup in the House of Commons, it makes it very difficult with a smaller committee to get MPs from anyone but the two main parties onto the committee. If you only have a committee of five, if you have two Conservatives, two Labour, then you need one from the minor parties, but again, the two major parties would argue they're not being equally represented there. In order to get the minor party representation, you've therefore got backbench MPs, and particularly parties like the SNP, calling for larger select committees in order to allow more minor party members to sit on the committee. But you've got the committee chairs wanting to reduce the number in order to make the committees more effective. There's no easy measure for this. The right proposals would perhaps allow this to happen without increasing the size of members. Another suggestion is that you could loosen the requirement about having balanced party membership. And if you said, okay, doesn't need to reflect the makeup of the House of Commons, well, then you could get as many minor parties onto the balances, onto the committee as you like. Again, though, the governing parties of the time are not that keen on that idea, because having a majority on the committee means that they are fairly docile. So there's an argument for further reform, and certainly the right proposals could give that further reform and weaken the power of the dominant party. But as yet, this hasn't happened. So in addition to the makeup and membership of the committees, the Wright report also called for select committees to be given greater access to the agenda of chamber. And this was followed through with the work of the Backbench Business Committee in freeing up parliamentary time for backbench business. And through this avenue, select committee chairs have been able to start giving more statements and proposals directly to the House of Commons seeking approval. However, it hasn't really become established practice yet. So one possible way of strengthening the links between select committees and the chamber as a whole might be to encourage more chamber statements by committee chairs, particularly on the publication of committee reports, and have more discussions there, maybe using the Backbench Business Committee and the Liaison Committee. But these haven't really come to fruition yet. Another issue to do with the select committees is that they've begun playing more of a pre-scrutiny role in relevant legislation that's being proposed. So select committees are playing a role in looking at and making suggestions to legislation before it goes forward to the bill stage. And again, that's going to give more backbenchers more power over the government's agenda, although it's fairly minor. Of course, the problem is most of the work on any legislation is still done by ad hoc legislative committees, committees of about 30 to 40 MPs, typically, each one created to deal with the amendments and suggestions of a piece of legislation. And these are basically appointed by the party whips, and the government party always dominates. And these aren't yet subject to approval from the House. So again, while the select committees become more independent, legislative committees are still firmly dominated by the whips. And that's despite the right reform, the right committee proposing that it should be made, the whole process of appointing to legislative committees should be made more transparent and should reflect that of select committees. Another significant proposal of the right reforms, of the right committee, sorry, was the introduction of a backbench business committee. Now, this would be made up of prominent backbench MPs that would be elected by secret ballot of the whole House, and its membership would have control over what was to be debated or done on a certain number of days in Parliament, which is usually about 22 days in the parliamentary session. This generally has been seen as a success, and the Backbench Business Committee has given an avenue to debate issues in Parliament that the government might not otherwise have debated. The Backbench Business Committee has linked in with the e-petitions, so they will debate matters that, well, they will consider for debate in Parliament any measures that get 100,000 votes or signatures on any government e-petition website. But they can also raise questions and debate motions about pressing issues of the day that the government might not otherwise want, and also introduce private members' bills. So there's a lot of scope there, giving time to the backbenchers away from the government's proposals. And this has generally been seen to be a good thing, but it is still limited. One of Wright's proposals was that the work of the Backbench Business Committee should have a high degree of certainty. The day should be regular and at set times and follow a set routine. And as yet, that's not the case. They are fairly ad hoc, and the timings are subject to change. So effectively, the government still has a lot of power over when the Backbench Business Committee gets to debate measures. It can also lead to a clash between the government and Parliament and the backbenchers. And it means that government legislation or government actions can be hindered by the Backbench Business Committee as time is lost or debates are held which the government can't afford to have. A good example of that could be, suggestion, the debate over whether or not to ban Donald Trump from entering the UK, which arguably may cause difficulties in the relationship between the government and America going forward, as Donald Trump has subsequently won the election. And while the Backbench Business Committee is seen as a success in rejuvenating Parliament and Parliament's power in relation to the government, the fact that it is still only 22 days that they get in a year is pretty limited. It means there's only a very small amount they can do. Proposals have been made, I think in 2013, to extend the number of days up to 35. But the government rejected this because it said it would lose too much time. So again, the government still holds all the cards here, and although it's been a step forward, the Backbench Business Committee has only really had a limited success in redressing the balance of power between the House of Commons and the government. Finally, with the Backbench Business Committee, is the issue of minor party representation. The Backbench Business Committee remains dominated by the main parties, particularly the Conservative and Labour Party. So those minor parties, at this stage, we'd say the Liberal Democrats, the Greens, UKIP, the various Northern Irish parties, they don't get a seat there, and therefore they still are excluded from backbench business debates and discussions. As a result of that, although the major parties are able to challenge the government, minor parties still lack a means of getting their voices heard in Parliament. Now, that might be fair in terms of their relative size or membership in the House of Commons, but it does still mean that those sections are effectively excluded, and that undermines part of the principle of parliamentary democracy. Now, having seen two successes for the right reforms, I'm going to look now at one of, well, perhaps the biggest failure, and that is the introduction of a House Business Committee. Now, that would be distinct from the Backbench Business Committee. Wright's arguments were that the House of Commons should control its own agenda, timetable, procedures, in consultation with the government and opposition, but not decided by the government and opposition. So it would be left to the House as a chamber to decide what was discussed, what was voted on and when, not the government. In order to do that, and to try and promote non-adversarial politics, the assumption was you could get a House Business Committee. And this would give ownership over House's business to Parliament, rather than leaving it with the government. That's not to say the government's agenda would not be progressed. It would just be that the House would have control over the timings and procedures rather than leaving it to the government. So in terms of how much of an impact this would have, there's a debate that it's fairly limited. But it would at least increase the or redress the balance of power between Parliament and the government. Now, there was a clear commitment in the coalition agreement to introduce a House Business Committee, but that has not yet happened. And the governments throughout the coalition era and into the Conservative government era have repeatedly refused to do this. So a House Business Committee, although it's been proposed a few times by backbenchers, has yet to happen. And now, this means that while there is still the Backbench Business Committee, which has complete control over a few days in the parliamentary year, the government still has control over the agenda and the procedures in the House of Commons. And although there is a demand for it among a number of backbench MPs, the government is resisting this. So the House Business Committee, as distinct from the Backbench Business Committee, has failed to materialise and is still facing opposition from the government. Another area of reform identified by the Right Committee was the need to engage the public further in the workings of Parliament. And rather than having Parliament as a body that just reported to the public, usually through the media, the public should actually be given opportunities to participate in parliamentary debates, perhaps even having an influence on the content of draft laws. Steps were taken in 2009 to advance this, with the creation of the Speaker's Advisory Council on Public Engagement shortly after the Right Committee gave its report in 2009. And that was to give the Speaker advice over how the House of Commons is to be perceived by the public and what should be done to restore the trust required between Parliament and the people it represents. Now, in May 2011... that committee set about its thinking on issues in a letter to the Speaker, giving suggestions about experiments in greater public participation, how direct public questions could be used and put to committees, as well as providing public comment for some areas of parliamentary business as it's being developed, all of which would have engaged the public far more in the whole legislative process. Now, some steps have been taken, although not necessarily by the Speaker or the whole House. It seems to have been led in many ways by the select committees who started using social media to get questions from the public. A famous example of this was when a select committee, the community select committee, was asking questions of the then Minister Eric Pickles, and it used the hashtag #AskPickles in order to get the public to provide questions that the committee would then ask for them. So in that sense, social media has been engaged to a limited extent, but there's very little evidence of social media or digital democracy happening or anything else happening other than petitions, which we'll come to, in terms of working of improving the workings of Parliament. Partly, this is based on the facts of life. Parliament does not have the capacity for large-scale digital innovation. The networks aren't there. It's an old building. The Wi-Fi and internet access apparently is not that great. And the capacity is just not there for large-scale digital democracy. Now, that could tie into this whole debate over the innovation or the reworkings, rebuilding, I suppose, of Parliament. And they could put in the facilities then as part of the redevelopment to allow for greater digital democracy in the future. But whether that happens, we will have to wait and see. Following on from all this is the nothing actually to do with the right reforms has been the wild success of the e-petition on the government website. Now, actually, Tony Wright and the committee wanted to emphasise the importance of paper petitions and give them a more prominent role. And they were a bit sceptical about e-petitions. But the coalition agreement came along and said 100,000 signatures and the e-petition can be considered for debate in Parliament. It does tie in with the right reforms because this was a power given to the backbench business committee, and they could decide once a petition had got 100,000 signatures, a member of the committee could propose a debate on the subject, and the committee could decide whether or not to allow up to 3 hours of parliamentary time to debate the issue. So this could be seen as quite an advanced innovation, and certainly we've seen with the debate on the Hillsborough inquiry that it did lead to pressure on the government. David Cameron, as Prime Minister, authorised a new investigation, a new inquiry into the Hillsborough tragedy, and it reported eventually that, yes, South Yorkshire Police had covered it up and that the Liverpool supporters were not responsible and were not guilty of what went on Hillsborough and the death of the 96, which... obviously, massive public success and a good sign for the public becoming more engaged in using Parliament. However, the fact that the Backbench Business Committee does only have 22 days in the year means there's only limited time for any measure to debate. So it's not as simple as 100,000 signatures and you get a debate in Parliament. There is also the issue of what debates are chosen. Of course, famously, the Backbench Business Committee held a 3-hour televised debate on whether or not Donald Trump should be allowed into the UK. Regardless of the public support, this was a debate that would have very little meaning because only the foreign secretary in the government could actually prevent him from entering the country. And actually... it wasn't really a major issue for British politics. However, it was a popular issue, and the sceptical might suggest that the decision to debate this and give up 3 hours of parliamentary time for it had more to do with getting the Backbench Business Committee and the backbenchers media time. It certainly was reported across all the major news channels, rather than dealing with a substantive issue. So there is a worry that this could lead to greater populism rather than quality parliamentary business. Equally, there is a challenge to this, just raise a concern. The greater public involvement can be a good thing, but it depends what we want from our MPs. If we want Birkin-style representation, in that we elect people to go and use their judgment and make decisions, then actually e-petitions and being told what to debate is not a particularly good use of time. However, if we would just want delegate-style representation, and we want to tell MPs what to debate, then actually this is quite an effective measure. One further slight problem with the e-petitions and the debates is that the public are a bit confused about what exactly they mean. Most of the public do now know that 100,000 signatures will qualify it for a debate, but they seem to think that it will be a government debate and that will require the government to act on it. They're not particularly clear about it. And if they actually knew that or realised that all the 100,000 signatures does is allow an MP to then bring it to a committee to decide whether or not they're going to have a debate in one of their 22 days in Parliament, it's actually very limited and it's likely that the public wouldn't be that impressed by it. So while in principle it's a good one, there perhaps needs to be more weight put to these e-petitions, and perhaps if they're going to meet the needs of the public, much more time and much more authority needs to be given to these e-petitions in order to make them a functioning part of British parliamentary procedure. So what can we conclude about the Right reforms? Well, the Right reforms certainly did open up the debate about how the House of Commons works, and it did lead to some significant reforms of parliamentary procedures. And particularly with select committees and the Backbench Business Committee, there has been some redressing of the balance of power between Parliament and government. However, quite a few of the significant proposals of the Right reforms that might have given Parliament even more power in relation to the government were ignored and remain ignored. And some of the reforms just haven't gone far enough. Even the select committees remain relatively weak, and the government still is in a position to dominate Parliament. The last thing to consider with this, just as the conclusion, is how much of an impact the Right reforms have made. Now, on the surface, you say select committees are more reinvigorated, they've held the government to account more, governments have been less able to dominate Parliament in the past. But it's debatable whether that's due to the Right reforms or more the fact that since the reforms were introduced in 2010, we've had a coalition government followed by a Conservative majority government, but with a very, very small majority. And in those situations, you would always expect Parliament to become more powerful in relation to the government. So the redressing of balance with Parliament becoming more powerful in relation to government since 2010 could well be down to some of the Right reforms, but it may have more to do with the politics of the situation and the fact that the government's, well, there hasn't been single party dominance over Parliament in the same way that there was under the Blair prime ministership, particularly in his first and second term with majorities of 178 and 163. So until we have another party, if we ever do, with another substantial majority, it won't be clear how effective the Right reforms and proposals have been. They have clearly made some alterations to Parliament, but there would be an argument that actually they have not gone very far and they have been limited in scope. Whether or not that's a good thing will very much depend on your point of view. I hope that's been useful and given you a guide to the Right reforms, which should be useful for AS politics, or if you're listening to this after the reformed ones, to the new A-level politics with a lot of focus on reform of the House of Commons. I will be doing another one of these, hopefully in the not too distant future, and I hope you're able to join me then. Thank you very much for listening.